Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, Chris Hayes from The Nation and MSNBC on reported Republican campaign plans to go after President Obama as a black radical. Also, Dr. Meg Jay on how people's brains are still forming in their 20s. WNYC's Elsa Chang on the federal court order yesterday to hear a case accusing the Stop and Frisk program of violating people's fundamental constitutional rights. And public art, what's the installation of your dreams and where in the city would you put it? All that beginning in just a minute, but I do want to take 1 minute to kick it off today with a reminder about our spring membership drive. This is day three. As you regular listeners know, we hope everyone will do your part to support the station, and we have a contest deadline this morning. Anyone who pledges by noon will automatically be entered to win an iPad and a MacBook Pro. You get both if you win. So if you were going to make a pledge anyway this year, why not do it right now while you get automatically entered into the contest? Pledge online at WNYC.org or pledge by phone at 1-888-376-WNYC, 1-888-376-9692. Thank you all so much, contest aside, for helping us pay the bills. Thanks to TechServe for donating the prizes, and hopefully a Brian Lehrer Show listener will win. 1-888-376-WNYC, 1-888-376-9692, or at WNYC.org. And the deadline to be entered into the contest for an iPad and a MacBook Pro is noon today. Now, our first guest to talk about some news is Chris Hayes, Nation Magazine Washington editor and host of the program Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC, weekend mornings from 8 to 10. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be back.
I see on your Twitter profile that you're a Cubs fan, yes?
I am a Cubs fan. Are we going to talk crickets?
Yeah, you bet. My heart goes out to you for the New York Times story today that the patriarch of the Ricketts family that owns the Cubs is behind a pro-Romney super PAC considering the most racially charged campaign yet against President Obama. Do you know anything about this besides what was in the paper today?
No. I mean, I just read the article that was in the paper today. I know that Ricketts has been part of, I would say there's a network. Sunlight Foundation has been doing some good work on highlighting some of the big conservative multimillionaire and billionaires who are now playing in the super PAC world increasingly, a lot of whom don't like, for obvious reasons, to get a ton of press attention. I know Ricketts has increasingly become one of those players, but I only know what I have read on the Times and the PowerPoint that they uploaded.
So if the article is right and the PowerPoint that they display actually gets used in the campaign, this would be the most racially charged campaign yet against President Obama, with an advertising blitz aimed at linking him to Reverend Jeremiah Wright by doing things like highlighting Wright's comment about 9/11, that the chickens were coming home to roost, and pointing out that Obama was in his congregation for 23 years and he was a mentor and things like that. Do you think they would actually do it, number one? And what impact do you think it would actually have?
I think they do it. I don't. One of the things about the new super PAC era is that it changes the calculation of cost benefit, right? If you are a campaign and you want to launch a set of ads like that, you have to take the incoming fire, right? I mean, you are putting yourself out there to be the recipient of backlash and recrimination and opprobrium. If you are just some random super rich dude who runs a franchise that hasn't won in over 100 years and could probably use your energies thinking about how to do that, but that's an aside, what exactly is the downside? I mean, you know, maybe you end up on the cover of the New York Times, maybe there's a little backlash around the margins, but you're not exposed in the same way a campaign is. And I think that's the reason that we're already seeing and will continue to see the incentive shift in the campaigning sphere towards the most maximally destructive, scorched earth negative tactics, because, you know, what exactly is the downside for someone who's just put a super PAC together?
On the other hand, I could argue that because of the informal relationship, even if not technically a formal relationship, between a pro-Romney super PAC led by one of his big supporters and the Romney campaign, and this would be true of any candidate of either party, if something that provocative, that was seen as offensive, were to hit the airwaves and other media, then there would be a lot of pressure put on the candidate to denounce it, don't you think?
Yeah, I think what's interesting here is we have not yet fully constituted what that norm will be, right? Because this is the first time that we are running a campaign under these conditions, or I guess the second time, and the first presidential campaign run under these conditions. And I think you're right, but you know what happens if Romney just says, look, you know, Mr. Ricketts can do what he wants with his money. It's a free country, and I believe in the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court has upheld the First Amendment in this way, and people are allowed to say what they want and express their opinion, and I welcome all sorts of, you know, I mean, what's to stop him from saying that? The question is, will there be a consensus amongst those covering the campaign and talking about the campaign that is insufficient, that Romney actually does bear responsibility for what attacks are made in his name? Let's remember, this was more or less what Bush said during the Swift Boat episode. I mean, he didn't condemn it. There was some pressure for him to condemn it, but he basically said, look, people can say what they want to say, and it proved to be very effective for him.
Chris Hayes, editor-at-large for The Nation, host of Up with Chris Hayes, weekend mornings on MSNBC. As we talk about some stories in the news today. By the way, did you see the phrase that this group used about how Obama tried to portray himself in 2008?
A metrosexual Abraham Lincoln.
A metrosexual black Abe Lincoln. And they will claim, if they go this route, that this turned out to be false advertising. But if if nothing else,
because he is beardless and heterosexual.
That might be why. But metrosexual is still heterosexual.
Sure,
right?
But I mean, like he David Brooks had his column about Barack Obama's ESPN style masculinity. You know, it was false advertising. It turned out he was really just a jock at heart.
Exactly. Well, if nothing else, it would make a great name for a band: Metrosexual Black Abe Lincoln. On a more mainstream campaign note, Romney unveiled his own debt clock, like the one in Midtown on 6th Avenue, for people who didn't see this on television and the, you know, video bites last night. At a campaign stop yesterday, it showed the total national debt climbing rapidly as Romney spoke on a digital debt clock. Now, when the number is in the trillions, as our debt is, the last few columns move really, really fast. So it looks like the debt is speeding upward. But the president is vulnerable here, right, Chris? Long-term debt for our children, our children's children, is a real problem. And the Republicans argue that they are more serious about tackling it because they're more willing to drastically cut spending.
Where to start on that? I don't know how vulnerable he is. I think there's an assumption that he's vulnerable on it. I think that the debt is the most important thing to think about, and I think to confront head on when we're having a political conversation about the debt, is that we are not talking about the debt when we are talking about the debt. The debt is a symbol. It's a token for other things. It's in the hands of the Republican Party, it is a symbol of the fact that we have lost our virtue, right? That we have become essentially licentious, that we just spend lots of money and throw it all over the place, and we've lost the self-discipline and virtue that made us a great country. The numbers are meaningless to people. A trillion dollars is a completely meaningless number. In fact, the debt in absolute terms is actually a macroeconomically meaningless number, because all that matters is what it is as a percentage of GDP. So you know, the clock is genuinely macroeconomically meaningless. I think that the political advantage for Romney actually is a question of consolidating the base, because this is something that does matter to conservative voters. I also think that
it does matter to independent voters too, though, don't you think? And even Democrats are nervous about what the debt means. People are watching Europe and things like that.
Right, but Europe is a very, very different situation, right? I mean, it's just important that we stay on the details here, right? The Eurozone crisis is a crisis that's specific to a currency union, right? The Europe is not printing its own currency. They don't have the Federal Reserve. They don't have the world's reserve currency. So they are in a very different situation, and Greece is in a very different situation, and their levels of debt are much, 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 much higher than ours. So yes, there is generalized worry, but my point is that generalized worry can alight upon the debt as a rhetorical trope that is useful to use in political campaigns. But even independents who say they care about the the debt, I don't actually believe they care about the debt as the debt. I think they see the debt as an indicator, a barometer, essentially, a thermometer put into the mouth of a sick economy that gives you a reading. For them, it's just another thing that shows we're in bad shape. And I don't think that if the economy got good or job growth was robust or GDP growth was robust, that people would care that much about the debt as debt. I think it's a useful, rhetorical, symbolic attack to make, but I'm not convinced that it's what voters actually do care about.
And we've certainly seen the debt, large as it may have been at other times, recede as a public issue when there were jobs, when there was economic growth. I think that's accurate historically. And now complicating all this, we have House Speaker John Boehner, as of this week, threatening another debt ceiling showdown later this year unless the Democrats agree to deeper spending cuts. They believe the president took the bigger political hit for the debt ceiling showdown last August. So apparently Boehner will force the issue in part by passing an extension of the Bush tax cuts before the election. And I could see the political implications of this going either way. Maybe it'll hurt the president, who I guess got hurt by the debt ceiling debacle last August. But the Republicans are often not seen as serious on the debt for not being willing to raise taxes at all.
Right. I mean, that's again why I talk about it in rhetorical terms. I mean, even Romney's big debt speech, the AP did a particularly pointed evisceration of the fact that the accounting doesn't add up at all. In fact, if you look at the Ryan plan, if you look at Romney, it's not a serious plan to get to reduce our long-term debt. And any serious plan, I mean, even look at, since you mentioned Europe before, austerity politics in Europe, right? Conservative governments that come into power and want to create austerity in Europe also have tax raises as part of the equation. That's just across the board the case.
That's true.
That's something that Republicans are completely existentially committed to never putting into effect at all. The political effect of the debt ceiling debacle, I think, was actually a symptom of the fact that the economy actually got worse, that there were real effects to the uncertainty created by the debt ceiling debacle. They're fairly quantifiable. They actually created adverse economic effects in the country. People actually lost jobs, income declined, bad things happened in the actual economy, and then that, of course, has a negative political effect on the incumbent. The terrifying thing is that we're going to rerun this again, and it's not surprising because given the way the game theory worked out the last time around, I think the Republicans could say that they walked away the victors, and so they have every incentive to do it again. Every incentive if you put to the side the macroeconomic health of the country as something that you're not that concerned about.
And the Democrats could say, look, by extending the Bush tax cuts, you're going to blow another $3.5 trillion hole in the debt over the coming years, and you don't seem concerned about that. And they can remind people of the payroll tax extension debacle in December, which actually hurt the Republicans. And that may have been the Tea Party's Waterloo, because I think Americans started to conclude then that Boehner and those forces just were trying to pick a fight with the president, even on tax cuts.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that was a Waterloo in the sense that they actually had to retreat.
Yes.
Whereas in the debt ceiling deal, I think you could say they, in some ways, they substantively came out the victors in terms of what both parties were bound to. Of course, we should also mention the other significant thing about the first time around the debt ceiling deal was basically the dynamics of it were we can't agree to anything because one side is completely obstinate in its refusal to consider really any genuine revenue raising, any tax increases. And because we can't agree to things, we have to essentially force each other to work together by creating a set of negative incentives that will act on both parties equally if we don't come to an agreement. Now, what is the first thing the Republican Party has done? What did they do last week? What did they pass in the House? They passed a bill to get out of that deal. I mean, just so we should be clear about the terms here. The first thing they've done in that we came to the eventuality that was set up in the terms of the deal, right? Mm. We're going to have this thing called the sequester when the super committee can't come to an agreement. The first thing they've done in the House is pass something saying, nope, 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 we're reneging on that part of the sequester. The question is, how can you make a deal with someone, any deal, right? How could you ever make any credible deal if it's just manifestly the case that they will welch on it at the first opportunity? Mm.
Chris Hayes from The Nation and MSNBC. We have 1 minute left, and I see you tweeted last night about the J.P. Morgan Chase $2 billion loss, and your comment was that the hedge funds own the water, and they will make Jamie Dimon, the CEO of Chase, pay through the nose. How did you mean own the water? Wasn't this loss from a hedge fund that J.P. Morgan ran?
Yeah, but the problem right now is that all the people who are on the other side of the trade of the so-called London whale. I mean, this story is amazing for a million different reasons. But basically, what happened was this guy was buying, was issuing a certain kind of credit derivative all over the place in numbers that were making people in the hedge fund world scratch their heads going back all the way to January and February. Once it became public, once they realized his exposure, J.P. Morgan now has to unwind that trade, which means they have to do the trade in reverse to get out of that position. But in order to do the trade in reverse, they have to go to the counterparties on the other side, right, and basically buy back what they sold them or sell back what they bought. And the counterparties think, no, we're not going to do it. We're going to let you twist in the wind, and the price is just going to go up and up and up and up. And so that's why I said J.P. Morgan essentially is on fire right now. And all the hedge funds who were getting screwed on the trade before, they're the ones that own the water to put the fire out, and they are going to make J.P. Morgan pay through the nose for it.
All right. Some thoughts on the news of the week from Chris Hayes, editor-at-large in The Nation magazine and host of the TV show Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC weekend mornings from 8 to 10 a.m. Chris, always a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Brain Lehrer and WNYC coming up next. Dr. Meg Jay. We continue our month-long weekly series with her. This week, the topic will be how people's brains are still forming in their 20s and what that means. Stay with us.